Hi there, I'm Germ.
I'm Worm.
Welcome to the Germ and Worm Travel Health Podcast. It's a big planet. See it in good health. I'm Dr. Paul Pottinger. You can also call me Germ. I'm a professor of infectious diseases at the University of Washington in Seattle.
I'm Dr. Chris Sanford, also known as Worm, associate professor in the departments of family medicine and global health, also at the University of Washington.
As always, we have so many excellent questions today on travel health from people across the country and around the world. Today, we'll talk about bats and rats in caves, botfly larvae in your skin, sunburns, tripping on ayahuasca, and so much more. But before we answer your questions, a disclaimer. Our podcast is designed to inform, inspire, and entertain. However, you should not use this podcast as clinical care. Before you travel, please see a qualified healthcare professional for advice specific to you and your itinerary. With that in mind, let's get started.
Our first question today comes from Michelle in Seattle, and Michelle asks, or states, bats, !! I'm always worried about hiking in caves or enclosed areas, not because of the bats, but because of guano. Not joking, really wondering.
Yeah, bats are no joke. And I think, Michelle, I love the way you said that. It's not the bat, like they're going to suck your bodily fluids out. It's their leavings and what happens with the droppings, or as we call it, the guano of the bats. So it's really interesting. It turns out that bats, fascinating mammals, they're so interesting. I love bats. I think they're one of the most populous, numerous mammals on the entire face of the planet, which is creepy in itself. They're just incredible that they've learned how to fly. There's so much to recommend an exciting life with the bats. But one thing I don't want you to do is to get too close. And it is, in fact, in large part for the reasons that you said. Number one, direct exposure to bats can itself pose a risk of infection. I'm thinking of rabies in particular. Number two, there are other infections that may emerge that we actually don't know about when you head into a cave. It may turn out to be a real problem. Hello, COVID-19. I mean, that may have come initially from bats. There are other coronaviruses, nipaviruses, many viruses that bats seem to get. Don't make the bat sick, but boy, they do tend to spread within the bat, which makes their immune system super fascinating and an important topic of study. And then you don't want any of those things, by the way. And then finally, it's also true what you said about the guano, and in particular, the concern for a disease called histoplasmosis, which is a fungal infection that can come to us as we breathe in air that is, well, that's befouled and spoiled and sullied by being exposed to the guano of the bats. So I would say caves are fascinating. I think bats are fascinating too, but I would really encourage you. Yes, what you said is correct. If you're gonna get exposure to bats inside caves, you should really do your homework ahead of time and decide whether that's worth the risk and are there things that you can do to reduce your risk. Thing number one, if you do anticipate having indoor caving exposures to bats, we really do talk to people about whether they should get their rabies immunization before they go. This is one of those higher than usual risk exposures to rabies. And by the way, rabies is basically a fatal infection and yet totally preventable with immunizations ahead of time. Would you give a rabies immunization to anybody who's even thinking of going into any particular cave? Do your homework ahead of time. Not all caves have bats, and so I think that's worth looking at your itinerary before you go and talking to your healthcare provider about that. And then number two, is it possible that you can protect yourself from almost all of these issues by wearing a good-fitting, high-quality respirator? So for people who are cavers, scientists, researchers, and people who are really into this, you will see them go into caving environments wearing what's usually an elastomeric half mask, the one that looks like, well, what you'd see somebody wear at an auto body shop painting a car or something, the rubber mask that covers your nose and mouth and has those little canisters, ultra high efficiency air canisters on the sides. That's not for everybody. If you're just walking into a large cave just briefly and you don't see bats around, you may not need that. But if you're going into an intense exposure, I'm talking about expeditions into caves where they're known to be bats, this can be something worth talking with your provider about. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, on the rabies vaccine issue, rabies vaccine is not something we recommend as a high priority vaccine for most travelers. So if you're going to Mexico City for a weekend or Cancun or Paris or most places, you could get the rabies vaccine if you want it, but the risk is low. Rabies is only spread by mammals. So we're talking dog, cat, rat, bat, monkey, not insects, not fish. And it's rare in international travelers. But as Paul said, it's rare, but it's essentially 100% fatal. Once you get the initial symptoms, our treatment is not effective. So you really don't want to get it. So we base giving the vaccine on risk. If you're going to be around animals, if you're going to be working with wildlife, with mammals, if you are going to be going into caves, we think it's a good idea. It's not a high side effect vaccine. People say, oh, is that the painful one that goes in the abdomen? No, no, that was many decades ago. These are just routine shots that go in the upper arm. So they're not painful. What's painful is when you get the bill for them because they are exorbitant in the United States, something like $1,500 for the series of three. So they're really pricey. We don't give it to most people. But long story short, yeah, if you're going into a cave, I think getting the rabies vaccine is a good idea.
Agree. And please send us pictures. We'd love to see what kind of caves you're looking at. I think they're super interesting. Okay, Chris, we have a question to you. This comes to us from Lee in Vancouver, BC. This is in Lee's own words. Lee says, I'm an idiot, and I lay in the sun too long, and now I look like a lobster. What should I do? And poor Lee, you know, if you had a time machine, this would be super easy. Is there anything short of turning back the clock, Chris, that could help Lee to feel better?
Well, first, Lee, don't be so hard on yourself. All of us who've traveled have made travel mistakes. I've done a count, and the number of potential travel mistakes are infinite, okay? And you never can make none. So part of going abroad is doing something dumb. And I mean, for example, I'm tall. I hit my head on things. I never feel intelligent when I do that. But that's just one of many things I've done. I've been sunburned and, you know, I've done all sorts of things. I would say when you do a dumb mistake, try not to do it repeatedly. You know, we do like to learn from our mistakes, but there's no need to call yourself an idiot. My second point is the first thing to do when you notice sunburn is get out of the sun. Even before you start thinking about treatment, what I wouldn't do is lay there and think, yeah, I'm getting sunburned, and then lay there and say, oh, what should I do about my sunburn? So step one, get away from the exposure, get out of the sun. A few other things you can do. Taking frequent cool baths or showers is of benefit. This helps with the pain. Use a moisturizer. And this could be, there's all sorts of things over the counter. Vaseline intensive care lotion is one. Eucerin, starting with an E, is another one that's a good moisturizer. This will give you some benefit. I would take, if it was me, some sort of analgesic by mouth. And the one I like is ibuprofen, but you could also take aspirin if your stomach tolerates it. Drink more water than usual. Sunburn can be dehydrating. If your skin blisters, this indicates a second degree burn, a more severe burn. Resist the temptation to pop the blisters. The fluid in there is sterile. The skin underneath is still forming. And they'll initially, break of their own accord. But you don't want to pop those prematurely. And also, while you're healing, you want to take extra caution about the sun and cover up with clothing and use sunblock as much as you can. And it's still going to hurt some, but these measures will bring down the pain partially.
I agree. I feel your pain. This is something where I have made that same mistake before, too. I remember as a kid being told that you should smear butter on your skin after a sunburn. And where did that myth come from? It's so wrong. I guess if you're going to be served up as a dish on somebody's buffet, so bad. Never, ever do that. One of the things that people ask me about a lot is aloe vera, and whether they should use it. As I understand it, aloe in the products that people get, it's basically water with a little bit of gelatin to help it stick briefly to the skin. I am personally not a fan of aloe because unlike the emollients that you're talking about that are really lipid-based, to me the aloe, well, it tends to evaporate pretty quickly, and I do not see it as a great way to hydrate the skin. Having said so, if somebody wants to use aloe, that's probably fine. I always advise them to add, after they've applied it, add that kind of an emollient that you're talking about to seal in the moisture.
You can burn yourself amazingly quickly under the equatorial sun, especially if you're coming from, say, the U.S. in the winter and you're fair-skinned. The sun can be roughly like a tanning bed, so you can get a little glow in 30 minutes and a bad sunburn in a couple of hours. So you really have to respect it, because it can ruin your trip if you have a big, painful rash for the entire rest of your trip. Okay, next. Ooh, this is good. This comes from Bill in Madison, Wisconsin. How do I treat a botfly larvae that you might get in the woods of southern Belize?
Oh, yeah, the botfly. I love that. So this is something that comes up in our practice in the context not only of Belize, but also Costa Rica and other fun places to go to in Central America. And the issue here is that when you travel to these locations, you may be bitten by a mosquito. Mosquito bites are common in the forest in this part of the world. Now, mosquito bites are a problem because they, as we've talked about, they may transmit a number of infections, viral infections, even parasitic infections. This one is a little different, and it's super creepy, because what we're talking about here is the botfly infection, and that's caused by a germ called Dermatomia hominis. This is a fly that needs to pupate or nurture its larva, its maggot, in the flesh of a mammal. Turns out that mammal flesh is warm and it provides nutrients. These maggots need to feed on us or other mammals. They're not necessarily specific just to human beings, although that is where we tend to see this happen. How does the fly get its eggs into your skin to grow? Oh, they are such sons of guns, because what they do, of course, is they take advantage of mosquitoes. The fly will actually lay its eggs on the underbelly of a brown common nuisance mosquito. That mosquito may not transmit a virus to you, but when it lands on your skin to feed, the egg gets brushed off from the belly of the mosquito onto you. And in effect, the fly has avoided all of the risks of having to feed on a big mammal that may swat it and kill it. The mosquito ends up taking all that risk. Bottom line, you get these fly eggs into your skin. They're super duper small, but they will start to grow and mature into the larvae of the Dermatobia, the botfly. Now, this is almost never truly dangerous, but it is really super duper annoying to people. The way this typically goes is that that larvae will grow and become bigger. Remember, it's in your skin. It needs to breathe. It's, you know, another eukaryote like us. It's an animal. And so it sticks its little butt out through your skin. It has two small breathing holes that it uses to breathe the air. And that's often when people know that something has happened. People will come to our practice saying, I have this pimple, a boil, but I think there's motion or movement inside. And if they watch it, and people will, they'll see these little black breathing parts coming in and out of the hole. There's nothing else that this could be. That's the one thing that it is, and we provide reassurance. People are usually super creeped out or very excited in some cases that they have this botfly larva inside their skin. If you do nothing, the larvae will crawl out of the skin, drop to the forest floor, and continue its maturity. You don't have to do a damn thing, is the answer to your question. You can leave them alone. The only time we intervene is when they come to our practice, because people really hate having these in, and I'm okay with that. By the way, they can become secondarily infected, although those bacterial infections like a staph or strep infection, interestingly, they don't always happen, which suggests that there may be some kind of antibiotic coating coming off the slime of the surface of these larvae. But anyway, what we do when we see them in our practice is we get them out of there, and this is relatively easy to do. The old-fashioned way to do this is to smother them, to put an occlusive dressing like a piece of saran wrap, some sort of plastic on the surface of the breathing hole. That way the larva it starts to suffocate and it tries to really come out of the hole and make it easier to grab. I have not had great success with this, although some people do. I like to use a venom extractor, which is basically a little suction device where we can attach a hypodermic syringe onto a little plastic cone. You pull back on the syringe, it creates negative pressure, and you can usually pop out the larva, which causes great excitement in the clinic. On a few occasions, I've actually had to use a scalpel and cut into the skin. That's usually firmer skin, like on the scalp, where this can happen. The skin of our scalp is really tough and fibrous, and so it's harder for for us to get them out that way. But again, the bottom line, you don't have to do anything. You can just leave them be. But if you want to go after them, you shouldn't do this. If at all possible, get to a healthcare provider who has experience with it. And if you're in an austere setting where you are days away from care, relax. Maybe take something to help you get through this process psychologically. You will not be harmed by these botfly larvae. They are not going to hurt you.
Right. They're fundamentally gross, but they don't end anybody's life. One strategy, if you're remote and you get one of these, is to put something occlusive over it. And this could be Vaseline, basically smother the thing. It'd be a piece of bacon or two. And the thing, as it starts to realize it can't breathe, will slowly emerge because it's really hard to grab when it's under the skin or impossible. But if you occlude it with thick Vaseline, as the thing begins to suffocate, it will emerge. And over, say, 12 to 24 hours, enough of it will come out to where you can often grab it with a pair of forceps. So this, the botfly, is a Latin American thing. The African equivalent is called the tumbu fly, often transmitted by laundry. People hang their laundry out to dry. You get these eggs on the laundry. So one way to bring the risk down in Africa of the tumbu fly is to iron laundry with a hot iron, and that tends to kill the eggs.
Yeah, the tumbus, they're even smarter, right? Because in that case, they're just literally putting the eggs on your laundry. And boy, for those of our listeners who've had tumbus, they can be quite a thing, even a little bit tougher to get rid of once they're actually in the skin.
Yeah, these things are gross. Even doctors go, oh.
I kind of like getting them out because it's super satisfying, but it is not something that most people want to go through. Okay, here's a question for you, Chris. This comes to us from Suzanne in Portland, Oregon. Is it easier to fly west or east to west?
You know, super question. First, a way to avoid jet lag, this isn't very pragmatic, but just for the record, I'll mention a couple strategies. One is to fly north or south. If you go, say, from Seattle to Baja, or from New York to Cancun, or from London to Ghana or to Portugal, there is no time change, and hence there's no jet lag. However, that's usually not where you want to go, so that usually doesn't come into it. Another thing that works, but also is not very pragmatic, is take a boat and take 2 weeks to get there. Back in the days of the sailing boats, people didn't get jet lag because they took 3 weeks to go across the Atlantic. And with that sort of gradual adjustment to the new time, you don't get jet lag. Okay, now back to the real world, you tend to fly, you get on the jet, you get off, it's eight time zones differently and you feel all spacey. And the answer to your question, Suzanne, is yes. It is more difficult to go eastward than westward. Our body has a natural pacemaker. You have these really interesting cells, actual pacemaker cells, in a part of the hypothalamus in the brain. And they synchronize every 24 hours in response to, among other things, light. So it gets light and dark in a typical 24-hour pattern so that you're awake and you're sleepy at the same time of day. And when you suddenly shift that by a number of hours, you feel spacey and confused and you tend to be awake at night when you want to sleep, and you tend to be sleepy in the day, and that takes several hours to get better. When they do studies on this, indeed, westward travel is easier, and this is because the natural body's circadian rhythm has a natural tendency to stretch out beyond 24 hours. And so you're kind of going with this tendency when you go to the west, you have a longer day. When you have a eastward travel, say even from Los Angeles to New York, a three-hour shift in time, you are shortening your day, which is the exact opposite direction of your body's natural tendency. And this exacerbates the daytime sleepiness, the nighttime insomnia, and just the general feeling of spaciness. Some people say it takes about 1 hour per time zone before you feel normal. So if you go all the way to the other half of the world, it can take a week and a half until you are feeling awake and sleepy at the right time of day.
I mean, I feel like I could travel west forever. If we could just keep going west, every trip should be to the west, and then we'd be completely fine. This is my fantasy. I actually hate jet lag so much. It's something that bugs me every time I go east. Coming west, I feel like I've just, well, like I could live forever if I just keep going that direction. It's definitely a difference in my own personal experience.
Now, I've got a question here for Paul. This comes from Jan in Seattle. This is a very specific question. I'm sure it's hypothetical only. If your cousin tests positive for COVID in Vietnam, should he report himself to the authorities?
Ooh, so Jan, my question to you is, do you like your cousin? how did you figure out that he was sick in Vietnam? No, this comes up all the time. So there's really two issues to me. I'm thinking about the COVID context. We are recording this conversation in the winter of 24. And so currently, with your specific question about COVID, you know, thank goodness, the virus has attenuated to a degree that, frankly, I find really surprising. And it's actually a better story than I would have thought could be possible. The COVID of today, COVID 2024, it's just not the same as COVID-19. And in fact, national, domestic U.S. and also international health authorities, they're really acknowledging this. It can still kill people. We still do lose people to COVID infection, unfortunately, at least in this country, every single day. So it remains a serious public health threat, but nothing close to what it used to be. That's because we all caught the original COVID. We've really forced the germ to become less virulent. Fitness from an evolutionary perspective is you want to spread to everybody and kill nobody. I mean, that would be success in Charles Darwin's perspective. And the virus is behaving very much that way. I'm emphasizing this because in the current context, most public health authorities internationally simply do not want to be bothered. They don't care whether somebody has COVID or not. Having said so, there are some issues with respect to travel. It's about getting on a plane or doing a rail trip or a cruise. If you're going to expose other people to your virus, this is something where, honestly, I think this is much less about reporting oneself to a public health authority. It's about personal responsibility. And I would hope that we would all make that decision to minimize our travel time until our symptoms are getting better, until a certain amount of time has passed. And by the way, that duration of time, it remains controversial. And it's actually something of a moving goalpost. The usual rule that I like to provide to people is that, interestingly, with respect to COVID, most infections seem to happen even before we begin to clinically become sick. The horse is out of the barn for this poor person. The usual guide, having said so, is that if someone is ill, they should be, if they're thinking of traveling, they should be well enough to travel. They have to be honest with themselves. Do they have the strength and stamina to do it? Number one. Number two, can they control their coughing and sneezing? It's those droplets that come out of our mouth. It doesn't come from our pores. It's not coming out of our urine. It's what we breathe. And so if you're able to control your coughing and sneezing, and certainly to cover up one's face with a high quality N95 or higher respirator, then the chance of you spreading it to others really is less. That chance goes down with the passage of time. What is the minimum amount of time that one should be sick before considering travel? Again, somewhat controversial. At the very minimum, someone should have no fever without taking acetaminophen or some other fever-reducing medicine. You should be afebrile, fever-free for at least a day, and ideally should be someone who's had symptoms for 5 days or longer before traveling. The reality is that if you're going to shave it close, let's say there's reasons why someone says, oh, it's day four of symptoms, can I travel today? I mean, the answer is yes, you can, but you really need to be, please, respectful of others. As bad as this is for you, your decision could be fatal to someone with a reduced immune system. So the clock is of, in terms of this question, reporting to a public health authority, I think, is not going to help anybody in most cases, although you're welcome to check with local health authorities to see what they want. It's much more about that courtesy to the people that you may be traveling with and just not spreading it around.
Yeah, we're in an interesting phase with COVID now where it's shifting from this world crisis to apparently a chronic thing we're going to have for the foreseeable future. And it looks like the vaccine is developing into something that's going to be recommended annually. And I think, as Paul said, the question is not whether to report it or not, but basically what to do when you feel crummy. And I think it's only good manners. It's being a good global citizen, whether you have a head cold or COVID or something else that could be spread to others around you, is to stay home until you're feeling better. I think it's extraordinarily bad manners to get on a jet while you're coughing out something that is going to infect the people close to you.
I mean, this is likely how you got it in the first place. What a bummer that is for you. It's an interesting societal question of how we handle this pandemic. And I think that question, in some ways we've failed, in some ways we've succeeded. That's why I really appreciate this particular question. Remains a threat, and I think personal responsibility is still a huge part of our successful plan. Well, having said so, Chris, I have a question to you from one of our listeners in Seattle. And the question is this: I want to go on an ayahuasca trip in South America. Is that a bad idea?
Well, interesting question. Ayahuasca, hallucinogen, shaman use it in ceremonies. People have visions. They have spiritual advancement, reportedly. And a certain number of Americans go down to the Amazon and engage in that. I would lean against it personally. It's a hallucinogen, and most people just have their spiritual moment. But a significant minority of people have side effects that are adverse, and this could be anything from nausea and vomiting to actually prolonged psychiatric symptoms. And in my mind, if you're going to use a drug for the first time with a fairly significant rate of adverse effects, once you've made the decision to do it, I would recommend doing it close to a medical provider you're familiar with. So if you get the prolonged nausea, you become overly anxious and paranoid for several days, which can happen, I'd much rather be in my hometown than in some jungle I was unfamiliar with. So you could, and a lot of people do, and I've heard some positive anecdotes from doing that, but I've also heard some scary stories about people having symptoms they didn't like and they couldn't make them go away and they didn't know what to do. And this was all made worse by the very unfamiliar surroundings.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think 2024 is a fascinating time because there's so many, there's just really renaissance and an interest in ways to use hallucinogens, psychoactive medicines, natural in origin or otherwise, that can really help some people with intractable, difficult psychiatric symptoms. Some people say, well, do you believe in ayahuasca? Oh, I believe the hell out of it. And this is a potent, powerful, psychiatric, psychoactive substance. The problem isn't whether it's going to do something, it's whether it's going to do the right thing and do too much. So I think it's exciting that we have this renaissance. I think it really deserves full scientific scrutiny. And if someone does choose to do so, boy, whether it's overseas or domestically, you have to do it in a circle of trust. You have to do it in a place that is recommended to you and where you're with people who can be there with you as your guide. If everyone does ayahuasca, that's a problem, right? Just like any other trip that someone would take, there has to be a chaperone there to do this with you. And so I think until we get more sense about the ways in which this can be used really for the good of people suffering from psychiatric conditions, it's a concern. Now, I'm an ID doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist. What I see again and again and again is people coming home from these ayahuasca trips, and they're just covered from head to toe with cutaneous leishmaniasis because they get stoned, they get high, they go on their trip. What they're doing is they're lying out there. They are breakfast, lunch, and dinner getting munched on by the phlebotomin sand flies. And so that's a bummer. At the very least, if you're going to do ayahuasca, please do it underneath some kind of fine mosquito netting so that you don't end up coming back with this tough-to-treat infectious disease. My pleasure to treat you. I will do my very best for you, but what a bummer when that happens.
Yeah, it's okay to be one with the jungle in a spiritual sense. You really don't want to do it in terms of being food for the insects.
100%.
Okay, Paul, this is from Michelle in Seattle. Michelle went to Mexico 20 years ago, and she went into cenotes, which are these limestone sinkholes. But she was nervous in the back of her mind because a friend of hers saw rats swimming in them. Anything to be concerned about?
Well, this is 20 years later, the quick answer is no, you're good now. If you were if you could turn the time back 20 years ago and you were about to get in the water, would you worry about this? The cenotes, they're beautiful. They're just super interesting. They are indeed limestone caves and caverns. And it's some of the best introductory cave and cavern diving you can do. There's a whole separate question around the safety of doing that. And needless to say, super important that you not just make this up, but you go with a Paddy or Maui certified dive master, that you go with someone who knows what they're doing and is familiar with that local cave and cavern. That has to do with drowning risk, not so much for the infection risk. To the question of Michelle, what about rats in the water? You know, rats are everywhere. They're all around us, and it's usually no big deal. They're just taking a bath and enjoying the cave like you are. There is one in particular infection concern in the context of a relatively warm temperature with rats, and of course that's leptospirosis. Leptospirosis is a bacterial infection. It's not exclusive to rats, but rats are pretty good at spreading it around. The Leptospira bacteria is a corkscrew-shaped bacteria. It likes to live in the kidneys of rats and other mammals and come out in the urine. So this really is an infection that human beings get when they splash around in the water that has been befouled by rat pee. And rats are like us. They like to pee in the water. It's just like a mammalian condition. They're no different from us. We get that infection when we are in direct contact with the water. You can literally get this, yes, through your skin, or if you swallow or breathe in small droplets of that water during your exposure. The classic things that you'll read about are these eco-adventures, adventure races that would take place in the South Pacific, for example. But the reality is, lepto is everywhere. Rats are all over the place throughout the so-called tropics and the tropical zone of planet Earth. And so you could pick this up from anything like that. The other classic way we see it would be in the context of an ecological disaster, such as a typhoon, a flooding in Bangladesh, Indian subcontinent, etc. And leptospirosis is a problem because it'll give you what feels like a flu from hell, high fevers, aches and pains in the joints. In rare cases, it can also cause real issues with your liver and a jaundice, meaning a yellowing of the skin, and the whites of your eyes that will not look right, a real liver injury. In other cases, there are exotic but very real issues with lung infection and lung inflammation, where people have difficulty breathing because they have so much inflammation of the lungs. Leptospirosis often does not even require antibiotic treatment. People tend to clear the infection themselves. And when we do give antibiotics, it's a drug called doxycycline, which is one of our classic for any corkscrew-shaped bacteria. Doxy is often the right way to go. So in this case, I would say you're good. You came through fine. And there are many people who go into the cenotes to dive. I'm one of them, and I've really enjoyed that myself. If I saw a rat swimming around, it would give me pause, I would say. I would not necessarily make my decision about whether or not to go in the water based on that. But I would also say if I came home and felt sick with a fever, I'd probably let my doctor know I had done that.
Yeah, I've also gone swimming in the cenotes and of Yucatan Peninsula and elsewhere. It's really fun. They're beautiful. But there's some risk. One thing that Paul and I do for travelers who anticipate a significant freshwater exposure in areas where there's lepto, like suppose I see a kayaker and maybe he's going to be in a sports event in freshwater in Central America, I'll actually start that person on doxycycline, which you can also take as a preventative drug, and that will very nicely prevent you from getting leptospirosis.
I agree. And the good news about doxy is it can also prevent malaria. So these tend to go together. I think if you really are going to have a lot of water exposure, as Chris says, talk to your provider about that. You may also need malaria prevention. Maybe doxy is the one stone to do both of those things at the same time. The downside for doxy in these beautiful areas, it can be a photosensitizing drug. You just don't want to catch a lobster-like sunburn.
Right. In fact, if you take doxy, you might want to do a little side effect trial in the U.S. Take it for a week, maybe get some sun if there is any, and if you fly well on it without side effects here, it'll probably be good for your trip abroad.
Well, Worm, that's all the time we have for today. And to our listeners, we would welcome your questions on travel medicine for our next podcast. You can submit questions to us by email, germandworm@gmail.com. Please also visit Chris's website, drtravel.com. That's drtravel.com, where you'll find all kinds of travel medicine content, including vlogs, blogs, podcasts, interviews with travel medicine specialists, a travel medicine guide, and other great downloadable content. I'm Germ.
I'm Worm.
We'll see you next time. This podcast is designed to inform, inspire, and entertain. However, this podcast does not establish a doctor-patient relationship, and it should not replace your conversation with a qualified healthcare professional. Please see one before your next adventure. The opinions in this podcast are Dr. Sanford's and Dr. Pottinger's alone, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of the University of Washington or UW Medicine.